yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now safe. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-5174.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. As this case comes before you, plaintiffs have two narrow claims remaining that in no way ask any court to make or review any policy choices or value judgments in military matters or foreign affairs. As a result, the claims are fully justiciable under the political questions doctrine. And I want to begin this morning by talking about the defamation claim. Judicial review...
You even got a claim there.
The defamation claim? We do, Your Honor. We have two alternative claims, one under the common law.
One depends on the proposition that anonymous leaks constitute final agency action.
Well, we think it's...
One depends on that proposition, right?
One of the two depends on that proposition. The APA claim
don't
does.
Don't spend a lot of time on that one.
Okay, Your Honor. But we have a common law claim as...
How do you have a claim against the United States for defamation?
Well the United States has...
You don't have any pleading even of anybody acting on behalf of the United States doing anything.
Well, we do.
You have anonymous leaks, right?
Well, we've alleged that anonymous agents of the United States have made these statements.
How many agents are there of the United States?
There are a lot of them. There are thousands of them.
They're acting anonymously. Are they necessarily acting within the course of duty or even arguably?
Well, that's a fact question. We've alleged that they are.
Be a pleading first. Now, you have not alleged that you have any information on which that's based, have you?
Well, we've alleged that there are U.S. intelligence officials, and in the course of their authority, they made these allegations. I think...
Don't you have to have information and belief and not just belief in order to make a...
Well, I think if you read the pleadings, you know, liberally with inferences drawn in our favor, these officers...
Well, inferences upon inferences upon inferences.
Well, the inferences are that officials acting in their official capacity made these claims against us, and we need discovery to find out who they were. And if the government thinks they weren't acting in the scope of their authority, they can say so in their answer, and, you know, the case will sort of follow through. If we...
You in the beginning, counsel, they don't have to get out from under an agent that you don't have.
Well, we think that there are agents or employees of the CIA, which is an agency.
And what do you base that?
Well, we base it on the news reports that U.S. intelligence officials...
said unnamed government sources, right?
Well, they said U.S. intelligence officials.
Okay. I will let you alone then. Go
ahead. I mean, Your Honor, we need to construe the complaint with inferences drawn in our favor. If under your view, you know, to the extent you say that we haven't alleged it properly, it would be difficult or impossible for people wronged by anonymous government officials to ever sue. We need to be able to sue.
You have any case anywhere where somebody successfully sued the government on the basis of an unnamed official?
Well, I mean, the Bivens case, for example, was against six
Bivens
unknown agents.
Bivens case had nothing
agents.
To do with defamation whatsoever.
No, well, defamation.
No, you had known event where you had identifiable agents whose names were not known to the plaintiff.
Well, in the defamation cases we cite, they were against known persons. For example, the Pierce case from this court allowed a defamation case to go forward against the HUD secretary for appearing and some of his assistants for appearing on the Nightline program. So I think the cause of action
with bags over their heads
is well established. No, they were known to the plaintiffs, but in our case, they aren't known. And
in fact,
you know, I think
we're nothing about them whatsoever. There's not even any way to identify them, right?
Well, officers can't hide behind the shield.
Suing the newspaper for defamation and then discovering where they got their information?
I mean, the newspaper may be protected by the First Amendment in ways that the government officials
well, they could raise that as a, they could raise that as an affirmative defense.
Sure.
And your person is not, perhaps he's a public figure, but that again would be an affirmative defense.
Sued
the newspaper and then discovered their source and then proceeded from there.
I mean, we could have sued the newspaper, I think, but I think we're also entitled to sue the government officials.
Okay.
And the cases hold that a party is entitled in discovery to find out the names of John Doe.
I'll let you alone.
John
you can
Doe
move on.
As long as we're on the defamation claim, follow on from the Chief Judge, you're answering why there's a claim. I'd like to know why there's a federal claim.
There's a waiver of sovereign immunity for all equitable.
What makes it federal as compared to a state claim?
Well, I think it works... There may be federal common law elements to the claim.
It's the maybe part that's troubling me.
Well, because as the Supreme Court's cases have discussed, when you apply federal common law to a state law tort claim or
why
claim like that against
why the are we applying federal common law here? That is,
well, there may be a U.S. interest where the United States is a defendant.
But in none of those cases has any court created a federal common law claim of defamation.
We're not talking about the creation, I don't think, of a claim here. We're the APA waives the sovereign immunity.
I got that part. Let me just turn over all my cards for 1 second here. Okay, you make this as an arising under claim under 1331.
Yes.
That means you have to have a federal cause of action. I understand the APA federal cause of action. I don't understand the defamation cause of action. Unless there's a federal common law of defamation, for which I've never seen such a case. That's where I want to know how you get there.
I think suits against the United States arise under federal law, even if it arose under state law.
What case has said that any suit against the United States arises under federal law?
I think if you look at cases like Clearfield Trust and Kimball Foods, those are suits against the United States. They apply this overlay of federal common law that may borrow
from
state law.
Yes, but those are cases where you're involving a federal instrument or you're involving a federal program and a contract under a federal program. I've looked. I haven't seen any federal common law defamation. Why isn't this just a state law claim of defamation? Now, you may have a federal, there may be a federal defense, right? You've cited some cases about, like Barr versus Mateo.
Right.
But you understand that under.
I understand your question. If you're concerned about the jurisdiction of this court, as you pointed out, the APA claim arises under federal law, as does our international law claim. So at a minimum.
That's only if you win the APA
supplemental
claim.
Jurisdiction.
That assumes you've won the APA claim. So let's go one at a time.
But
with respect to the defamation claim, for us to have jurisdiction has to be arising under, right?
Right.
Is that right?
Well, right. Unless you read the waiver of sovereign immunity as being
creating a cause of action.
Not as creating a cause of action. Definitely not. But as being a grant of subject matter jurisdiction. Similar to the way the APA similar to the way the Federal Tort Claims Act works or the Federal Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act works.
That's interesting because the Federal Tort Claims Act, notwithstanding what the government said in its brief, does not create a cause of action.
And I'm not contending that the APA waiver of sovereign immunity creates the cause of action. These are all state law causes of action to which the government in the FTCA context and the APA context has waived immunity. In the Foreign Sovereign Immunities context, they've waived the immunity of foreign governments.
But
all of these claims come in as state law claims.
The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act creates jurisdiction for the federal courts. The Federal Tort Claims Act doesn't. Neither does the APA. And so I'm still looking for where we get the arising under.
Again, I think the arising under comes first from the fact that the claim is against the United States and there are federal interests there.
But just to be clear, the only cases are similar to this. You cite Boyle, for example. Boyle cites a defamation case. But the defamation case is one which creates a federal defense. And as you know, from Louisiana versus Motley,
right.
That's not enough for a rising under.
But it's not only a set federal defense. The federal common law may affect what we need to prove as an element of our cause of action. This hasn't been litigated. You know, in Pierce, the court allowed the defamation claim.
But it didn't say whether
to go forward.
We don't know from Pierce whether it was a state claim or a federal claim.
We don't. Pierce cited, I think, District of Columbia law.
Right.
So, you know, but even if it were viewed as arising under state law, I think there's, like I said, there's supplemental jurisdiction here, and even if the other claims fail, there's the discretionary balance that the district court would need to use to decide whether to retain jurisdiction of the state law claim. I have a hard time believing, Your Honor, that if we had filed the defamation in state court, the United States wouldn't have removed it to federal court and insisted it occur in federal court. I would think the United States has an interest in having claims against it adjudicated in federal court. And I'm thinking there's, you know, that overlay there of federal common law provides the jurisdiction. It may be that the waiver of sovereign immunity provides the jurisdiction as well. Not creates the cause of action, but provides the jurisdiction. Of course, there's Article III jurisdiction whenever the United States is a party.
I want to ask you about your theory about why this is not doesn't present a political question. Your theory is that it's not a political question because the allegedly defamatory statements you challenge were not the reasons the president gave for the cruise missile attack, right?
Right.
That they were later explanations designed to cover up a political embarrassment.
That's one reason why we don't think it raises a political question.
Well, let me ask you if that's really right, given what happened here. When the president announced, explained the reason for the attack, he gave two reasons, right? One was that this was a plant making chemical weapons, and secondly, that the leak statements that the plant was, quote, and this is from your complaint, associated with the Bin Laden network, right?
Right.
Okay. Then the leak statements accuse your client of being, as you put it in your complaint, connected to Osama Bin Laden, right?
Right, and other allegations.
So aren't they essential? They're exactly the same. I mean, except for the fact that that in the later statements they associate it with your client, both the president and the leaked statements charge that the plant is associated with Osama bin Laden.
Right, but
so for us, for a court to determine whether the charges against your client are true or false would directly challenge the president's reason for striking the plant.
I don't think that's right, Your Honor, because when the president made his allegations about the plant that it had connections with bin Laden, that's because he thought it was owned by the Sudanese government corporation that had connections.
But he didn't attack the plant because of who owned it.
Because
he didn't attack the plant because of who owned it. He was retaliating against Osama bin Laden for the attacks on our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania.
Sure.
And in fact, at the same time, he attacked training camps in Afghanistan. He was attacking Osama bin Laden. He was attacking a facility that he thought was associated with Osama bin Laden. The owner of the plant was immaterial to the attack.
Well, the owner of the plant was immaterial to his decision to attack the plant.
Right, that's my point. So I don't know how a court could possibly adjudicate this case without directly undermining or challenging the president's reason for the attack.
Well, all of the original reasons for the attack could be perfectly valid, even if a court were to find that Mr. Idris was not affiliated with bin Laden, because none of the president's initial allegations were based on Mr. Idris. He's a new piece that they
added. His initial allegation was that the plant was associated with Osama bin Laden, and that's essentially what the leak statements say, too. So if Idris is not associated with Osama bin Laden, and there's no claim any longer that, except for Idris, that the plant was, you're directly challenging the president's rationale for the strike.
Well, Mr. Idris was a piece added to the puzzle after the fact, and
that's right. The ownership was a new piece.
Right.
The president didn't attack the plant because of who owned it. He attacked it because of its relationship with bin Laden.
But then after the fact, the anonymous officials said that they attacked the plant because of Mr. Idris's relations and because of that ownership.
Because he was associated with bin Laden. That's
right.
Why. They didn't attack it. They didn't just pick him out of the blue because he was a Sudanese businessman. They picked him out of the blue because they picked him because they thought he was associated with bin Laden.
Well, we allege they picked him because they
For example, the president, when he announced the cruise missile attack, had given the reason that they gave in the leaked statements. They said exactly that. And they said, this is producing chemical weapons, and it's owned by Idris, who's associated with bin Laden. That would be a political question, right?
No, that wouldn't be a political question. That's a separate reason why we think it's not a political question. I do think there is a difference between the allegations made and the allegations against Mr. Idris, so that if a court were to find Mr. Idris innocent of any activity, it wouldn't impugn the decision at all. But even if the president had rested on those allegations, I think one of the points we've been trying to make in this case, and this goes to both our defamation claim and our international law claim, is that a court may review the facts, the truth or falsity of the facts used to justify a political decision in the military field. It can't review the judgment of the president in making it. It can't say that the president didn't do enough diligence before attacking the plant, or that the president acted recklessly in acting without enough information, but after the fact, it can review the accuracy of the decisions. You see this in the detainee.
I can distinguish between a judgment that the plant was not associated with Osama bin Laden.
From a
judgment as to whether that plant created a security risk for the United States that justified a military attack.
Or it's the latter judgment that is insulated from review by the political question doctrine. The first question, the judgment to act.
Unwrap them.
I'm sorry?
I don't see how you can unwrap them.
Well, I think they get unwrapped in the post-9/11 detainee cases where a judgment is made to seize a purported enemy on the battlefield, and nobody thinks that the reasonableness of the detaining military officer's decision to snatch the guy off the battlefield could be reviewable, say, in a negligence lawsuit. But after the fact, the accuracy of those facts, whether or not
the detainee cases are easily distinguishable, however, right? I mean, in the detainee cases, we have a clear commitment in the Constitution of the judiciary having a role for reviewing executive detentions. We've been taught that in Boumediene and Hamdi and the other cases. We don't have anything like that.
There is a constitutional commitment for habeas review.
The habeas review speaks of detention at the time of the review. You do not have to make a decision as to whether the commander had enough to act on when he seized. It's whether there is enough presence to hold now.
But that's the same distinction we're trying.
It's not at all the same.
It is the same, respectfully, Your Honor, because we're not asking for any court to weigh the evidence that President Clinton weighed at the time he made the attack. We're asking for the court to weigh the record at the time, at a subsequent time, at the time the statements were made. After it came out that the evidence
reasons as of the time of the seizure.
Yeah, look at your prayer for relief.
At the time of the seizure.
Your prayer for relief seeks a declaration that that Mr. Idris or El Shifa are not connected to Osama bin Laden.
We do seek
whether,
that
whether or not El Shifa was connected to Osama bin Laden. That's the reason the president gave for the attack.
But that's the reason detainees are detained on the battlefield, and those questions are reviewable. It's the same thing. It's an example I used when arguing before the panel last year was when an individual is in a dark alley and sees someone approach him with what appears to be a gun and he fires on him and kills him, that can be reasonable self-defense, even if it turns out after the fact that the person shot was a child with a water pistol. And it's the first action, the reasonableness of the defense. Here, the reasonableness of President Clinton's decision to defend the country by bombing this plant, which is off limits to judicial review. But the fact of the matter, what the facts that underlie the decision are, have been a subject of judicial review in all sorts of cases. And
indeed, as I understand, later on, the National Security Advisor said, he never saw, or maybe there never was, but I think just he never saw any intelligence connecting the plaintiff to this plant. And then the president in his memoirs recounts that the National Security Advisor later said that, and says, based on the information we had then, I believe we did the right thing there. Now, you're not going to challenge that, right?
That goes to the distinction I've been trying to draw, and I apologize if I'm not making it clear. We can prevail on our claims, I believe, even if we concede that the president did the right thing at the time. The president needed to act at the time based on incomplete information and based on his assessments of the risks to our country.
And then somebody else makes a statement of what you're complaining.
Someone else makes a statement.
That may or may not have been the same statement that the president believed, but they say it's based on new evidence.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. It's based on new evidence, so I think that breaks... That
who,
breaks
who,
the chain.
Who said it's based on new evidence? Where does that come from?
That comes from one of the anonymous quotes.
Yeah, and in your complaint at 66B, when you talk about the Washington Post, I think it's pretty clear that the new evidence there is only that the link was more direct than had first been supposed. It's not new evidence of a completely new justification, as Judge Tatel's question.
Well, if you look at
the same justification, it's just more evidence of it. And why shouldn't we expect that to happen in almost every instance where there's an initial strike based on incomplete intelligence, and as we learn more later,
Well, based on the preceding paragraphs in the complaint, you see that the government never alleged that Mr. Idris was the owner of the plant or had ties to bin Laden
after. The issue isn't the plant. The issue isn't the Mr. Idris. It's the plant, connections to the plant. Let me pose to you a hypothetical. Let's imagine that there is a military attack on a foreign facility. Let's imagine that there were two reasons the government had for conducting the attack. On reason number one, they're 80% certain of the intelligence. But it's something that's so sensitive that they can't disclose it in a public justification. So that's reason number one. Let's suppose there's a reason number two. Now, they're only 20% certain of the accuracy of their intelligence on that. But that is something that they can disclose. So they choose in the public statement justifying the attack to rely upon the 20% statement. Well, as you can see, what's going to happen, it turns out that the 20% statement with reliability actually turns out to be false. Would the government be liable in defamation for giving that reason on which they only had 20% reason to think that it was accurate?
Well, that may go to the substantive standards of defamation.
Well, but that's what you've asked us to do. You've brought a lawsuit that asks this court to get into the elements of defamation.
Well, right. The level of reasonableness of the government's statement may be part of the substantive allegations.
And what are the standards that we would use to determine the reasonableness of the government acting on incomplete intelligence?
We're not asking whether the government's decision to act was reasonable. We're asking whether a statement made subsequent to the military decision made to the public was true or false.
In my hypothetical, they give a public justification based on something that they really weren't very certain about. Let's put it down to 5%. Okay, 5%.
But on the allegation,
if it was made with reckless disregard to the truth, I think we could recover.
So how do we determine that reckless disregard for the truth?
I mean, there's...
How do we determine that in national intelligence and security matters where the executive is being, we hope, is acting as quickly as possible to protect the national security interests of the United States? Has to act with dispatch. Do we have standards for that?
I think the court can, we're in an incipient stage of this case, and I think a court can craft standards to, based on the common law of defamation.
And how in the world, in crafting those standards, can we avoid making the very determinations that the political question doctrine tells us we are forbidden to make?
Well, we have terrorist designation cases, we have terrorist detention cases where these decisions are made, and the quantum of proof the government has
In none of those cases are we asked to pass upon the wisdom of the decision.
Again, I think here we're not asking anybody to pass on the wisdom of the decision to attack the plant. I am willing to concede that the president could have had 1% chance that this evidence was correct and think that 1% is a grave enough risk that it justifies the military decision to attack the plant. But the facts, when later republished to the public...
Even if you're right, I take your point, okay, about the court might not be questioning the presidency, but even if the court, even under your theory, the court would at least be saying that the president acted on incomplete or inaccurate information. And isn't that the same as questioning the basis for a military strike?
Counsel, if I understood your allegations, is that this was invented, not that it was misconstrued.
Well, we do allege that it was invented, yes.
So if you want to go on with Judge Griffith's hypothetical, fine. But in this case, if you're talking about invented information, you don't need to resolve that problem.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. I'm sorry, Judge Tatel. Can you...
My question was, whatever a court does in adjudicating your defamation claim, won't it, and let's assume it concludes, as you allege, that the statements are false, right? At a minimum, it will be questioning the completeness of the information that the president acted on, right?
Right.
In other words, isn't that correct?
It may end up, there will be a record that the facts were incorrect, but...
Right. That is that the president acted on... Right. You say the president acted on the basis of the information he had then.
But that's right? Not relevant to...
But what the defamation verdict would say is that the president acted on the basis of inaccurate information or incomplete information, and isn't that just as fundamentally a challenge to his military decision as a decision that it was false?
I don't think it is, because it doesn't cast doubt upon his judgment. It only is a decision about the quantum of evidence he had.
The president of the United States launches a military attack on incomplete or inaccurate information doesn't question his judgment? Sure it does.
Not necessarily, because as I was saying, the president can act on a minor chance that there's a harm here because of the size of the harm. So you take the risk.
But the judgment in your favor would, let's assume he acted on the basis of 5%, right?
Right.
He just, they had a little bit of information. The risk was so great they decided to challenge it. So you have a judicial decision saying that's false. That says he acted on the basis of not just 5%, but zero. Inaccurate information.
You have a judicial decision that the underlying facts are X or Y, but that doesn't cast doubt. Like my example of the police officer who shoots the child with a water pistol. If we determine that it was a child with a water pistol, that establishes what the facts are. It doesn't cast any doubt on the reasonableness of the police officer to act in self-defense to save himself from what was reasonably perceived
as a threat.
You don't have a political
question or anything similar on the officer's reason for shooting in the first place.
Right.
Well, it's not a perfect analogy. There's no political question there, right? But
you don't have a parallel case. The whole thing could be questioned in that instance. There's not a shield like the political.
The whole thing could be questioned there. I'm just trying to draw a distinction here.
Can I just play out for just 1 second what happens if you get to the next stage? You don't want to just see the new evidence, right? You have to see the old evidence.
We have to see the entire record.
Right. But so by bringing this lawsuit, if you are able to proceed, this means that the object of a missile attack by the United States gets to see all the evidence that the President of the United States acted upon at the moment at which he decided to launch a missile attack, believing that he was responding to a direct attack on the United States. Is that right?
We would get to look at the evidence they have of Mr. Idris, including any evidence. We allege they didn't have evidence at the time about Mr. Idris.
That's your allegation, but you're not going to be satisfied. You're going to want to see. You, for example, you say that they said, this was from page 5 of your brief, that at the time they claimed that bin Laden had a direct financial interest in the plant, right?
Yeah.
And you say you're the owner of the plant. So there must be some intersection of those two. So in order for your case to proceed, merely by filing a defamation suit, the owner of a plant that's bombed by the United States, at least allegedly in response to an attack on the United States, gets full view of all evidence of whether or not bin Laden had a direct financial interest in the plant.
I'll answer your question, Your Honor. I do want to save some of my time for rebuttal.
You want to answer the privilege question?
More time.
You want to answer a privilege question now?
I'm sorry, the privilege.
You want to answer a privilege question now?
Well, I mean, the information may be discoverable or may not be discoverable based on the government's answer. I think there are techniques the district court has to protect information from being disclosed to the public. It could be filed in camera. There may be ways even to prevent the plaintiff from seeing it if the government has a significant enough interest in that. So.
But you don't disagree that we would at least get to the issue of some kind of review of the evidence in front of the president at the time he launched the attack.
I disagree that we would necessarily have to based on these allegations. The case may evolve into something where.
You mean if the government confesses, then you won't.
The government may confess.
They don't look like they're about to confess.
Well, they don't want to have to answer, Your Honor. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Now, on the political question doctrine, can I ask one question, which is it your theory that if you're bringing a statutory claim as opposed to a claim based on a violation of the Constitution, as you are here, you're bringing a non-constitutional claim, that the role of the courts is simply to enforce the statute as is, unless it impermissibly intrudes on the president's Article II authority, which would be a separate determination, and that there's no political question doctrine that applies in statutory cases?
Well, I think the political question doctrine does apply in statutory cases. I think whether or not there's a statutory right to action is irrelevant to the political question doctrine, which focuses on the nature of the question being asked.
Okay. Explore that further, but cases like Japan Whaling suggest that in statutory cases it's different.
Well, I was relying on this court's recent decision in Zivotofsky where they said the statutory cause of action is of no moment to the political question doctrine. Thank you, Your Honors.
You have nearly 2 minutes left. We'll round it up when you get back to your
thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Beth Brinkman on behalf of the United States. Plaintiffs want an extraordinary remedy here. They're seeking a retraction at the highest level of the executive branch of the explanation that the president gave for a military strike in the immediate wake of that strike. That remedy cannot be reconciled with the separation of powers doctrine, and that is what creates so many problems in this case. That's why there's no cause of action. That's why there's a political question, and that's also why there's no waiver of sovereign immunity. I wanted to go first to the political question.
So can I ask you a hypo on that? Suppose Congress passed a statute giving someone a cause of action if they're falsely labeled a terrorist or a member of Al-Qaeda by the U.S. government. And they expressly gave a cause of action and waived sovereign immunity and provided a remedy, say, of up to $50,000 for anyone falsely labeled. And that comes to court. Someone brings a case, comes to court. Would we just throw up our hands and say we can't enforce that statute because it's a political question?
No, Your Honor. I think that's where you look to the People's Mujahideen and the other cases from the D.C. Circuit, where you've looked at these statutory frameworks that Congress has set up to review designations of terrorists, where the term terrorist is defined by a statute. Right. And in that case, this court looked and said there were three steps that had to be decided and that this court could decide two of those. But the third step was whether or not the organization posed a national security threat. And so the court separated that out. So I do think there could be that
and
role.
What was it about the third step that was a political question?
It was the idea that, looking at the Baker versus Carr, the idea of what is the authority of the executive in the relation of foreign affairs and in assessing the type of national security threat that we threaten by that organization.
Why wasn't that present in the first two inquiries? Why wasn't that present in the two first factors, the court?
The other two factors were whether or not the organization was a foreign organization and whether it met the statutory definition of terrorism. But when you look to see the more open-ended question of whether an organization poses a national security threat, you get into all the kinds of problems of non-justiciability. There are no standards for this court to assess foreign intelligence gathering, the degree to which, as the court was talking about, the certainty
why isn't the case that the plaintiffs bring here raise the same type of question that we said we could review under the first two steps of the statute in People's Mujahideen?
Because those were very limited statutory framework in which Congress set forth the definition of terrorist and had a limited review of the record. In one of the statutory frameworks, it relies on hearsay evidence, and that's a different kind of category than the very...
Why is it different here? The gravamen of the complaint here is that whether this fellow was linked to bin Laden. Why isn't that the same type of inquiry?
Well, the gravamen of the complaint here, Your Honor, is a defamation claim. And I want to go to what counsel has talked about, that the question the court would be deciding is whether or not this was true or false. It's not the question of defamation claim, and this is why what Judge Garland pointed out is so important. The question is whether or not these sources knew or should have known it was true or false.
First,
that's
since you brought
question.
Up the remedy, and since you've referred to People's Mujahideen, even in those cases, the remedy was not close to the remedy sought in this case.
That's exactly right.
In those cases, there was an official designation. And the most we did, even in the cases where we could get past the political question, the most we ever did was vacate the decision of the Secretary of State that they were foreign terrorist organizations and send it back for further adjudication. We never ruled in any case that we were deciding that it was a false designation, did we?
That's right. Here, the dramatic nature of the remedy that they want a retraction in the form of a press release from the highest levels of the executive branch, disclaiming the grounds on which the president had relied for a military strike. And
any court in the United States ever ordered a press release by any branch of government, whether the highest or lowest?
It's an extraordinary suit, and that's why there are these constitutional problems that permeate all aspects of it. I wanted to mention
Your answer to my question seemed to suggest that the political question inquiry really turns on whether there's a sufficient statute. Statutory framework, which in the end melds the political question doctrine really into the merits determination.
No, Your Honor, we think that in those cases there's a statutory framework that was crafted to make a more limited to review. It isn't a kind of question that's going to a executive, the president's decision to initiate a military strike. It's a much more limited framework and standards that Congress has created, so it doesn't intrude on the executive's authority. Well,
isn't that really the same thing as saying it's, and maybe this is the better way to analyze it, that you look at the statute and you see whether it violates Article 2, whether it intrudes on something that's exclusively committed to the president's constitutional authority. For example, selecting bombing targets is usually considered something exclusively committed to the president's Article 2 authority. Isn't that the way to analyze something like that?
I think that certainly that would apply here because this is at the core, the apex of the executive's authority. I think looking at different statutory frameworks, that might be a harder line to draw, but that certainly would support our position here. And
the reason I ask that is because the political question doctrine is the dog that didn't bark in a whole line of Supreme Court cases going back really the whole history of the Supreme Court, but certainly the modern detention cases, the government raised the political question doctrine in Razul and argued that this was asking the courts to opine on the legality of the president's ongoing military operations and to release individuals who are captured and who the military has determined should be detained. That seems core political question the way you're articulating it here, yet the court didn't even bother to deal with it. Was so, I presumably, considered such an insubstantial argument for no judicial review.
Well, no, the Supreme Court there looked to the textual commitment and the longstanding tradition of the habeas corpus authority of the judiciary, because here it's the separation of powers, it's the balances between the various powers that are given to the branches from the Constitution. So I think that was a very important aspect and really is the way that the Supreme Court distinguished that. I did want to go back to just the intrusiveness of the claims here and how the political question is really at the core here. In addition to having to look at all of the evidence, because you have to know whether or not the speaker knew or should have known it was true or false, you'd have to know.
What evidence?
The evidence which had been the justification for the military action by the president.
The claim is that someone other than the president at a time later on made a statement that was false and defamatory. And why do you have to look at the evidence that the president looked at when he made his decision?
Because the allegations are that these high-level officials who were part of the executive.
I don't think it even says high-level, but passing that. So yeah. Why do we have to look at what the president knew?
Because if these officials knew the evidence on which the president had relied, and if part of that evidence was 100% certainty that this factory was producing chemical weapons and 100% certainty that those weapons were somehow connected to Osama bin Laden, that person knew it, there is no way there could be a finding of defamation. That person should have known that a statement about Mr. Idris, the owner of that facility, being connected to it could be false. So that is the way in which you cannot disentangle them.
If the later justification was, in fact, new evidence, completely new evidence, completely unlinked from the prior justifications, what do we do with the political question analysis in that circumstance?
That may be a somewhat different analysis. I think it's more complex. First of all, the very decision to give an explanation for a military strike by the president is a discretionary judgment. It's a policy call about foreign policy, about the message that we send to our allies, to our enemies.
Are there any cases that say that other than the panel opinion, which we're considering now?
No, Your Honor, but I think that when you look at the authority of the Constitution and the president in the area of foreign affairs, the Constitution makes clear that it is the political branches that have that dialogue with the global political situation, and that's very much.
Okay, I get your point. So what's complex about that then? You said this is a little more complex.
Because if it was made perhaps by a person who had no, if it was 10 or 20 years later, if it was by a person who had no access to the original information that undergirded the president's decision, that's a different situation. And we're not saying everything that touches on foreign policy is a political question. So I think.
Well, it may not have been, it certainly wasn't 5 or 10 years later, but it may well have been somebody who had no knowledge of the president's actual basis for his decision.
But the question is defamation. You have to look at all of that person's knowledge, whether they knew or
should
not.
The president's knowledge, the speaker's knowledge.
Yes.
And if the speaker doesn't know anything about what the president knew, he just made this up and said it, why do you have to get into what the president knew?
Because the allegations of the complaint connect.
That it's false, and there would have to be there's a burden of proving that it's false.
Well, Your Honor, throughout the complaint, the plaintiffs allege that these were justifications, and in fact, in their in-bank brief, when they present the question presented, it's on page 2. They're asking whether the political question bars judicial review of a defamation claim, alleging knowingly false accusations made against a private individual by government officials in purported justification of a prior military attack.
That's presumably why the official said it.
Yes, so it's not as if it's some kind of separate statement about Mr. Idris.
Well, we don't know who said it. We don't know. You haven't answered the complaint.
That's because it's a political question that's beyond the justiciability of the court.
Very precisely, what is the question that is political here? What is the question?
Whether or not the explanation for the president's choice of a military target in retaliation
by someone else,
by a high executive level official, is known or should have known to be false.
Okay, first, do we know that is the allegation that it's by a high executive level official?
Yes.
Well, it has to be high enough to bind the United States.
Yes.
Because the suit is not against the official, but the United States.
That's right.
And that's all we know.
That's all the allegations have. That's correct.
And the plaintiffs have suggested that that if the government has to answer this, they may not contest the falsity anymore since they released Mr. Idris's assets at the Treasury, right, which were based on the same understanding initially. Right, so he protested that or litigated, I don't remember which, and the assets were unfrozen. Is that correct?
The assets were unfrozen, that's correct.
Weren't they unfrozen because he showed that they were not involved with terrorism?
No, there's no allegation of that whatsoever. In fact,
what is the legal standard by which the Treasury unfroze the assets?
That's not in the record, Your Honor. It was
it's a matter of law, just a question about the standard that's in the law.
There was no standard because there wasn't a lawsuit that was dismissed before the, a lawsuit.
There isn't a lawsuit, but there's a statute that authorizes the Secretary to act, right? And it depended upon these assets being implicated in terrorism, did it not?
Yes, Your Honor, and at the time
he reversed himself and released the assets, which he presumably would not do if they were the product of or in support of terrorist activities.
Well, the record on the allegations appear on page A26 in the complaint. It's paragraph 73, and it talks about a senior administrative official. This is at the time of the withdrawal of the blocking of the assets, and it says, we made a judgment that we had concerns based on sensitive information, but we're not prepared to compromise those sources for the sake of this case. That says nothing about not thinking there's a connection. It's suggesting
You're relying on the statement of a senior administration official made anonymously to the press?
I'm relying on their allegation, Your Honor.
That's what's in here.
Right. That's the allegation.
Because that's what appeared in the press.
But that's their allegation. And so there's absolutely no suggestion here. In fact, to the contrary, it suggests that there were other more important national security issues that were factored into that. If I could, I'd like to turn to
return to the question of whether there's a waiver of sovereign immunity here. Mm-hmm. I think you said earlier that there was not, because they were seeking an extraordinary remedy. I think maybe the plaintiffs would say there is a waiver precisely because they're not seeking damages.
I think, Your Honor, that really, if I could step back for a moment about the question of the cause of action, I think that's part and parcel because we have to know what the cause of action to see is where this waiver of sovereign immunity would come from. And as is quite clear, obviously, under the Federal Tort Claims Act, there is no action for injunctive relief. So plaintiffs have to try and create a cause of action for defamation. And they look to two places to try and make this up. One is common law and one is the APA. When you look at common law, there's nothing there. There is no federal common law of defamation. The Supreme Court has repeatedly made clear that that is not the role of the federal courts to create federal common law. So then they try and create an APA cause of action.
What about their state common law claim?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
What about their state common law claim?
Their state common law claim, I think they try and, well, a state common law does not run against the United States.
Well, what about that CNV versus Pierce case? Isn't that what that says? We remanded for just that. Pierce was a federal official. We remanded it for consideration of a D.C. common law defamation claim against the Secretary of HUD.
Two things I would say about Pierce. First of all, in the paragraph remanded, they say something, and the parties have paid no attention to this claim whatsoever. You know, it was not a developed ruling by this court. It remanded, and the court said there are a lot of problems with this by on the way on the remand. Moreover, and more fundamentally, Judge Tatel, Both Pierce and Kirk were decided before the Supreme Court's decision in Meyer versus FDIC and before the Supreme Court's decision in Flamingo. And those cases really make clear this two-step analysis that's required. First, a waiver of sovereign immunity, and this is why I think they're related, Judge Brown, the waiver of sovereign immunity. But then the question that you still have to have a cause of action that's against the United States.
So Pierce is wrong to the extent it implies that there's a state common law cause of action against the United States.
Yes, it's an implication. There's no holding in that case.
Wrong or no longer good law.
I think the implication would not be one that you could derive from that case after Meyer and Flamingo. And so, Judge Brown, that brings me back to your question. So you're looking for a cause of action. So where plaintiffs then try and go is to the APA. But for an APA, then there's an APA waiver for non-monetary relief. But then you have to have a cause of action, and you look at the APA cause of action. The APA cause of action has to have a substantive law that's being violated. It's important to understand that, and the state tort law can't do that. We cite a Fifth Circuit case, Supreme Beef, I believe it's called, that really makes clear. That was a case where there was a waiver of sovereign immunity under the bankruptcy law, and then the party wanted an offset and said, well, there's state tort law. State tort law doesn't run against the United States. So it's not a federal law that can be pointed to as a substantive law which is being transgressed for an APA cause of action.
Aside from the transgression of substantive law, APA requires a final agency action, does it not?
That's right, Your Honor.
Anything here which remotely resembles a final agency action?
No, Your Honor, these statements were less than, we would say, than the press releases that issue in Trudeau or Hearst Radio.
There were at least press releases of an identifiable agency.
Well, also, there are no legal consequences flowed. There were no rights adjudicated or determined by it, and that's what is the final agency action standard.
If we agree with you.
The claim is that there were that there was a harm, that his legal rights were invaded. That's part of the.
But under the APA, Your Honor, it's the requirement of having a substantive law pervades the APA. Under 702, it talks about aggrieved within the meaning of a statute. It talks about legal harm. It talks about whether it's contrary to law. It's just not a made-up grievance. You have to have a substantive law that's
He's alleging a taking of his reputation. He has an interest, a constitutional interest.
But that's not a federal cause of action.
Let me ask you this, though. Suppose that, I take it, though, from our cases, that if there's a political question here, it doesn't depend upon the government being involved. If there's a private action that involves a political question, we would decline to resolve that question, correct?
Yes, I'm the political questions that I'm, cases that I've all looked at, allege action by the government.
Well, if the Jew against Japan does not,
mm-hmm.
right? That's a private action.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Suppose Idris turns around and sues his insurance company for the loss of his property. They makes a claim. They deny it. He sues. They say it's outside the insurance policy, because you were involved in an act of terrorism. You're using the plant for purposes of terrorism. It's not covered. Now, you have a factual dispute about that. Would a court be unable to adjudicate the insurance claim?
If it did not involve the question of the explanation given by the United States.
Well, that's exactly what the insurance company would point to. That's all they have. Is the public report from these unnamed officials that there was a terrorist activity involved.
Yes, that insurance litigation could not, undertake a determination of the truth or falsity of the president's.
Of the unnamed official's statement, truth or falsity of that. The claim is some unnamed official made this up. And now he can't get his insurance claim?
But, Your Honor, the only way to make that factual determination is to look at what that person knew. And the allegations.
Well, it may be and it may not. It seems to me that's a discovery issue, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, that there are not standards. When you look at the totality of the Baker versus Carr.
Why don't we look at the specifics of Baker versus Carr? I haven't heard you mention the case until now.
Your Honor, certainly.
Which of the six, or how many of the six factors there are you relying on?
A majority of them. You look and you have the textual commitment to the political branches of foreign policy, military.
But not of truth or falsity of a defamation claim.
But this is an explanation. This is explaining to the world, to our allies, to our enemies, to the citizens of the United States.
By an unnamed official who's acting after the fact?
These are executive branch officials who are explaining. This is in the wake of the missile attack. This is, and when you read the 9/11 report, there were still debates going on about whether there should be further. This was on the same day in coordination with an attack on Afghanistan training camps in an attempt to get Osama bin Laden.
The claim is that this statement was not only false, but was based on invented information after the fact. If that's not true, he loses.
But it can't be adjudicated, Your Honor. There aren't standards. For example, I think the
suppose that the source is identified and asked, where'd you get this information? And he says, I made it up.
Your Honor,
that's more or less what they're claiming. But if suppose they're right,
their allegations throughout the complaint and in the question presented, I read before, as both the Federal Circuit, who also found a political question in their takings claim, and the panel here, the majority opinion recognized, are alleged to be explanations by high executive level officials. And that has to be, Your Honor, because you have to understand how this case originally came. Their claims have been rewritten on appeal. This was an action against the president for a declaration that he made a mistake. That is the remedy in the complaint.
I think they've jettisoned that.
But that is the context in which these allegations came. So the high executive officials
They're not defending everything.
It's
clear they're no longer defending everything that
Absolutely.
They put into the complaint. But they've got a core here that they are defending, and that's all we're
But we're talking about the scope and the allegations about the knowledge and the level of the executive officials here. And it's in that context that you have to look at what they are alleging. They are alleging that these are high executive officials that are explaining why the president made the missile strike.
Suppose the president issues a pardon. He pardons somebody named Smith who was convicted of murder or something. And the next day, at the press conference, at the press briefing, they ask the press secretary why the president did it, and the president said, well, because evidence showed that Smith did it. And Smith too? He's been accused of murder by the press secretary.
And the question would be whether there could be
a political question. It goes right to the pardon power.
If there was a lawsuit that challenged directly the
president's my case. That's nothing. Those are the facts. It says the press secretary and other people leaked information that Smith murdered the person. I say it's not true. You've ruined my reputation.
And was this an action in which the president was granting a pardon, and this was the reason he was granting a pardon?
We don't know. The president just granted the pardon. Didn't give a reason. And then the next day, the explanation was given by high government officials that it was Smith who committed the murder.
That, I think under the Baker versus Carr standard, you may have a political question because of the core constitutional right of
There has to be that that's a political question, right? There would be no remedy under those circumstances.
And I think it's one of the core the core constitutional authority of the president to grant a pardon.
There's also no cause of action in that case, right? And
that's
if we agree with you that the cause of action is completely devoid of merit under Steele Co., right, we don't even have to address the political question issue, right?
That's right. And I would also say,
is there any reason for us to, in your judgment, if we conclude that there's no cause of action?
No, because I think part of the reason there's no cause of action, Your Honor, is has constitutional underpinnings that go to the limitations of the court also.
Right, because Congress recognizes the same things that you're talking about here, and Congress rarely passes statutes that impinge the president's national security authority or the executive's national security authority. So the issue rarely arises of the kind of hypothetical I presented earlier.
And also the discretionary function exemption, Your Honor, to the Federal Tort Claims Act. There is, and this court has recognized, that there's a constitutional separation of powers aspect to that. And I'd also point out the APA has exceptions for things that are left to the discretion of the agency. But when you look at the discretionary function exception to the Federal Torts Claim Act, that's why it really cuts out the legs from under their argument that, oh, this is an injunction versus monetary relief. When Congress enacted the Federal Torts Claim Act with all these various limitations and exceptions from waiving the government's, the United States' immunity in torts, they made clear that there was discretionary function exception. And when this court has looked at, for example, the Suits and Admiralty Act, this court and many other courts have had to imply and read in a discretionary function exception in that situation because of these concerns of not
but
intruding.
That's not necessarily justiciability then. That, now you're asking to actually create a defense. I thought the argument in your brief about committed to agency discretion under the APA, that's under Cheney versus Heckler, is at least justiciability, whether we call justiciability jurisdictional or not. That makes it at least equivalent to political question in order with respect to Steel Company, and we could decide it on that justiciability ground before we decided the political question. Is that right?
That's true. But I also think the cause of action argument, at first blush, it doesn't perhaps sound like it has the same jurisdictional limits on the courts.
Well, it would be the jurisdictional cause of action argument if under Bell versus Hood were not colorable because there is no federal cause of action for defamation, that would be an absence of subject matter jurisdiction. That's what the court said in Steel Company and in Bell versus Hood.
Yes, yes. And we also think when you look at the cause of action they would want to create, it would intrude on separation of powers because there would not be this discretionary function exemption that the court has realized has these constitutional underpinnings and has had to read in to, for example, the Suits and Admiralty Act.
Ms. Franklin, let me take you back to Judge Tatel's hypothetical for a moment. The president issues a pardon, no explanation, and the president's White House spokesman, or press secretary, later says he pardoned Jones because Smith committed the murder. And Smith has no action against the press secretary or the United States?
That would...
Okay, why is that a political question? What is it that's... Because the president has the pardon power, the press secretary has the destruction of reputation power?
Well, there's certainly a textual commitment to the president of
the pardon
power.
But this is not the pardon. This is a statement and justification issued by someone else.
Right. And the first thing I would want to say that I was right. There is no cause of action, of course, from all of our arguments.
My
there
question
is
whether there's a political question, or the judge's question was, and you said yes.
Assuming there was a cause of action, it would raise many of the problems of the judiciary trying to find a standard, trying to
for whether this is a defamatory statement?
This is the spokesperson for the President of the United States.
Yes.
The immediate day after.
They don't walk on water. They're human.
The immediate day after explaining why the President exercised his pardon power. And that decision to give an explanation for the pardon power is part and parcel of the president's authority in that very unique bailiwick of the president.
What if he put it in his memoirs 10 years later? You've emphasized the day after. Can it be that he has a license to libel for the rest of his life?
I do think when you have statements that are much in time removed, the question about this inextricably intertwined becomes more challenging.
How much more challenging? I mean, enough to make it not a political question. I don't, you know, obviously you have a long line and I don't want to ask you exactly where you draw the line, but you can't, are you arguing that for the rest of his life, the president's spokesperson can say whatever he wants about other people having been guilty of a murder?
No, and that's what I think that this court's political questions opinions have looked at and really recognized that the authority of the president in unique areas were foreign affairs, military operations.
Pardon.
For this one? I mean, what if somebody decided to accuse Mr. Idris in their memoirs? Not the president, perhaps because he might have a different kind of immunity, but some CIA official.
Well, Your Honor, I think in this case, we're looking at the initiation of a missile strike, military action, foreign affairs, which is really the core authority of the political branches.
You were asking about the pardon case, Judge Garland. Let's stay with the pardon case.
Well, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking if the president said something in his memoirs.
Well, I doubt there's a big distinction, but I'm very happy to continue. I think Judge Ginsburg is right to ask this question on the pardon power because it opens the same issue. So I assume you're saying that at some point the president's spokesperson can't suddenly come up with something that wasn't said before. And how do you distinguish that? What's your grounds for distinction?
I think if the spokesperson is still providing, as alleged in this case, and is presented an explanation for why the president acted, that would still raise a political question.
And it's his explanation, not necessarily the president's. We don't even know that it's true, that it is the president's justification, right?
The gravamen of this complaint has explained that these were justifications by high executive officials for this action.
Right.
So in that,
not by the president and not necessarily held by the president.
But if
uttered by someone else and maybe or maybe not.
But if this court were to create a cause of action for defamation, and there isn't, you would have to have that cause of action created before you could bring that kind of suit also. And if you had that cause of action.
Judge Ginsburg is asking not to shift ground from political question to cause of action.
Thank you.
We drew a distinction in Wilson versus Libby.
Mm-hmm.
And you cite that in your brief for a different proposition, but you don't suggest that we were wrong in drawing the line there. Now, that's an assistant to the vice president, high official.
But that was a question, Your Honor, about disclosure. It wasn't about a policy decision. It wasn't about the decision to initiate a military strike.
Well, it had to do with the president's State of the Union address and why the president thought it was necessary to invade Iraq.
But the allegations there were about whether or not there had been an illegal disclosure. And so that the question that was being answered there was not questioning the policy determination, whereas here what they want is this amazing remedy of a retraction of the statements that supported the president's exercise of a military strike and a declaration that it was false and defamatory. That really goes to the core of the political
question. The declaration part's not so amazing, is it?
Your Honor, one of the factors in Baker versus Carr is the idea of having competing voices speaking in the conflict between different branches. That's directly what would be presented by that. Not to mention also the idea of speaking with more than one voice in foreign affairs in a very significant area of national security, and all of this in the immediate wake of a significant military action against us on our embassies abroad when this was made in conjunction with the attacks on the Afghanistani training camps as well. That certainly would bring the court into the impermissible area that is precluded by political question. If there's nothing further.
Can I just ask, are you relying then on this Baker versus Carr embarrassment concern or lack of respect, those factors?
It's hard to differentiate that, Your Honor, in my mind, of that from one of the other factors in Baker versus Carr.
I mean, I understand you want the commitment factor, but in answer to Judge Ginsburg, you said, well, a lot of them.
I think it's very akin to the multifarious voices factor in Baker versus Carr, and I think you look at them as a totality, but we have not singled that out as a particular factor in this case.
If the I can see how if the court were to resolve this claim for the plaintiff or even to pursue it for the plaintiff after the defendant shows that it had some basis for the statement, how exactly that problem might arise. But we haven't gotten to that stage.
We have
an allegation that this was invented, and we don't have any contradiction to the effect that, no, there was some basis for it other than in the president's memoirs.
Well, for the reasons we've stated, Your Honor, we submit that it would require the determination of knowing or the speaker's knowing or should have known the that was false, and that would require an evidentiary investigation.
Surely we can agree that if the president has some intelligence report suggesting that this plant was used for the purposes alleged, that he's justified in doing whatever he did or what he did, right? The claim here is that a statement was made later based on nothing. And if it's based on something, then the Baker factor just mentioned may kick in. But if it's based on nothing...
Your Honor, your hypothetical suggests that every court would agree that the president had a justification. That's exactly what the political question...
Not a good justification, any justification.
But the hypothetical of the 80%, the 20% being able to disclose the 20%, mm-hmm. not the 80%, mm-hmm. and then the 20% turning out to be wrong, that's what the Constitution leaves to the political branches.
Of course, and the court would not wade into that. There's no question about it. But suppose the answer is, well, we really... The official says, I don't know what the president had. I had nothing. I just made this up as a diversionary matter.
The allegations here of high executive officials.
Yes, that's who did
it. And what they knew or should have known is an inquiry that
reckless disregard for the truth, right?
Yes.
Okay, so he says, I made it up. It was a diversionary tactic. It wasn't the smartest thing.
But it wouldn't matter if he made it up, Your Honor, if, in fact... There was evidence, maybe that he didn't even know about, that there was evidence that the factory was connected to chemical weapons and it was connected to Osama bin Laden. That would mean that it was true. And truth is a defense to defamation. If there's nothing further, Your Honor, we ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the scope of the government's position is pretty breathtaking here. They contend that government officials can make up lies about private individuals just by tying it back to a prior non-justiciable decision. And I'm not aware of any case that authorizes that or finds something like that to be a political question.
Says we can order government, the executive branch, to issue press releases on any subject.
Well, we don't necessarily need an order of a press release, Your Honor. We'd be happy with a judicial declaration of falsity. We allege actual malice in the complaint.
You were asking us for an order requiring the executive to produce a disavowal, weren't you?
Abandon it.
Well, I'm sorry.
You wanted to
disavow. Am I not correct that you were asking us to issue an order directing the executive to make a statement that this was a false statement?
We've asked for injunctive and declaratory relief, Your Honor. We've asked for both. We'd be happy with a declaration that this was false. We allege
You're
actual
abandoning
malice.
The injunctive claim?
Abandoning
the injunctive claim?
We're not abandoning it, Your Honor, but if you have trouble with the remedy, we're also asking for declaratory relief.
You don't want to answer my question as whether that's ever been done by any court anywhere.
Well, I'm not aware of it being done, but Pierce and McGrath, well, McGrath was to strike, but Pierce recognized the availability
of
a retraction.
On Pierce, can you address Ms. Brinkman's point that the case, even if it was corrected at the time, is no longer good law?
Yeah, I think this court and the Supreme Court of McGrath understood the distinction between a waiver of sovereign immunity and the creation of a cause of action, even prior to the Supreme Court's decision in FDIC v. Meyer. The sovereign immunity waiver is in the APA, just like it's in the Federal Tort Claims Act.
There's the cause of action arises
out of state law. You refer to state law first, just like you do under the FTCA.
The FTCA is a federal law that expressly borrows state law to fill out the cause of action.
Well, or the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. I mean, the cause of action arises under state law. The FTCA does not create a federal cause of action. It allows causes of action that exist. It waives the government's immunity as the sovereign for causes of action that exist against its officers under state law. Here we have officers who acted. They could be sued, you know, prior to the waiver of immunity, they shared in the government's immunity. So without the FTCA or the APA, a federal officer could not be sued in tort for his torts. But after the waivers of immunities.
But that before the FTCA, a federal officer or the U.S. could not be sued in state court for common law torts, correct?
That's correct. And so I think once you have the waiver of immunity that comes from the APA in this case or from the Federal Tort Claims Act, in the case of damages cases, the state law cause of action can be asserted against
APA waives the U.S. government's immunity from all state law torts?
Unless the waiver has been, for all torts, I do. I don't think the FTCA removes the waiver, as the government argued in its brief. It's not an implied, as this court held in the Kirk case, it's not an implied retraction of the immunity waiver.
Can I ask a question, the same question that Judge Kavanaugh asked with respect to a federal statute, but with a slightly different timing? Could Congress, I take it from your brief, that if Congress passed a statute that said someone can sue the president or, I don't know, the CIA director for describing what the justification for a missile strike was at the time of the strike, not subsequent, that that would not be justiciable, that would be a political question?
Can sue them for
would be unconstitutional, I guess?
If the question only goes to the facts, I wouldn't concede that it would be unconstitutional. I think
would it be a political question?
I don't think it would be a political question if it's only the factual justification. But
well, so in, what do you mean in your brief where you say this does not call into question the propriety of the president's policy-based decision to strike the El Shifa plant, which all agree is non-justiciable?
I've been trying to draw a distinction here between the policy judgment of whether an attack should be made versus the factual accuracy of the justifications. I think if we're just talking about whether an attack should be made, that would be unconstitutional or non-justiciable.
So you also say that the defamation claim in no way challenges the wisdom of that decision or requires a court to second guess any aspect of that decision. I may have misunderstood then. So you're taking actually a sharper position than I thought. Would it not require us to second guess the president's decision if we were to determine that he had absolutely no facts supporting the explanation he gave?
You know, I think the public might second-guess the decision, but I don't think the court would need to because the court is just adjudicating the sort of facts in the record. It's again, the distinction between nabbing someone on the battlefield and detaining him. You can make a policy judgment to act based on incomplete information, based on threats, based on the president's assessment of the risks and the pros and cons of acting. Those are political questions that this court and the Supreme Court have said are not justiciable. But you can look at a record and determine the factual accuracy of claims. And I think that's not a question that's in the traditional wheelhouse of what courts do. They determine facts.
How do you distinguish that from the Mujahideen decision where, with the third factor, that, where we held that the question of whether the organization presented a threat to the security of the United States was a political question. That's the decision the president made the day he launched his cruise missile attack. He concluded that the plant, because of its affiliation with Osama bin Laden, created a threat to the security of the United States.
Right, and I don't think you can question the president's decision whether the plant was a threat, whether it was threatening, based on what the president knew he needed to take out the plant.
A court could question whether or not it was affiliated with Osama bin Laden as a factual matter.
I'm sorry, can you repeat?
Is that your distinction? In other words, the court could adjudicate the question of whether, in fact, the plant was affiliated with Osama bin Laden without questioning the president's judgment that because it was affiliated with Osama bin Laden, it presented a security threat to the United States? Is that your distinction?
I think there is a distinction between the two. You can determine, you know, whether a terrorist group is a threat or not is a political decision.
No.
Whether someone's a member.
But in our case, the president determined that it was a threat because of its affiliation with bin Laden. And your point is that the court can adjudicate the latter fact without questioning the overall judgment? Is that your point?
I mean, I think the court can adjudicate whether persons or property are in fact terrorists or enemies, and the courts adjudicate those.
I'll just try once more because you're out of time. Because I don't understand the distinction, and maybe you can help me. I don't understand how, if the president says, I believe this plant is a security risk to the United States because of its affiliation with bin Laden, what I don't understand is how a court could question that fact, that is, whether it's affiliated with bin Laden, without undermining the president's judgment that it presents a threat to the United States.
Well, the president's judgment is that al-Qaeda presents a threat to the United States, and the president's judgment was that there was enough evidence to justify attacking it, and the court can review the record. But the court need not do that in this case, because on the defamation claims, our allegations are that these claims were made with actual malice after the fact and had nothing to do with the original decision. The government has not come into court to deny those allegations. It's attempting to get the case thrown out on justiciability grounds at a very premature stage.
You recognize, don't you, that we haven't parsed the difference between policy and implementation quite to the point that you're asking us to do. In Gonzalez-Vera, we were very clear that the implementation of policy in the foreign policy area gets just as much protection as the policy decision itself.
Well, the implementation of policy in the sense that the harms that flow from it, that was a case where the government decided to support the Pinochet regime, and it was a regime that allegedly tortured and murdered innocent individuals, and the decision to support the regime was also the decision to accept the policy consequences that flowed from that, and the court couldn't pass judgment on the policy decision to support one regime or another.
Why aren't public justifications for military strikes part and parcel of the same policy determination to go to war?
Why are they not? Well, we allege this was a completely fraudulent policy justification, for one thing. So in this case, it's not.
Fraudulent policy justifications are now subject to review by the court.
Well, it's a
fraudulent decisions to go to war.
Well, it's not the policy decision to go to war. It's a government official coming after the fact and saying, you know, the decision to go to war has been challenged. The administration has been embarrassed. And then some government officials, we don't know if they had the president's authorization or not.
Why aren't decisions to detain certain people part and parcel of the president's decision to go to war?
Well, they could be under the same, you know, we've been trying to say that the detention decisions support us in this case. Because the decision to
it's hard to
go
distinguish.
To war,
we're doing the same thing every day in the detention cases that
If Mr. Idris was
all political questions here.
If Mr. Idris was detained in this case, I think there's no question that the very same facts that we're attempting to adjudicate in our defamation case.
There's a textual commitment of the Constitution to the courts to review executive detention.
Well, if his property was seized and he sued as he did and then the government dropped its case, he could have gone into court and under the Holy Land case and other cases, he could have had that adjudicated. And again, those are the same facts, and there's no habeas textual constitutional commitment in the context of designating these organizations. And yet this court allows the factual question of an organization's affiliation.
Aren't liberty and property interests a little bit different here than what you're talking about? We're not talking about liberty or property interests.
I don't think the interest of the plaintiff has ever influenced the political question determination. Cases like Harbury where plaintiffs the estates of plaintiffs who were killed and murdered. So the severity of the plaintiff's interest doesn't affect whether it's not. It's a political question. We have property interests here. Our client is an international businessman, and the defamation has impacted his ability to do business in the United States.
If you've got that one answered, unless there are further questions, time has long since expired, and we will take recess, and the case will be submitted.
Thanks very much, Your Honors.
Bench.
I don't know, maybe 10 per minute.
Yeah. Yeah. Good seeing you.
Yeah, good job.
Okay, good you too. Yeah.
Let's get off to the table. Okay.
Put him right there.
Yes. Just gonna put him at the end. I'll move them. Bring down. But the just go ahead and disconnect everything, and I'm not quite sure he was doing the wiring.
You get a prize, yeah.